This is the Afternoon Brief on High FM with Michael McKenna. Focused reporting, sharp analysis, and the local stories shaping our lives. Daily updates in a fast-paced world.
The chairperson, the coffee machine, and the jobs challenge. Well, welcome back to our weekly news roundup, where we will unpack the biggest stories shaping our country right now, beyond just the headlines. Well, joining us as always, we welcome in studio Eliezer Enfield. Eliezer is a third-year politics, philosophy, and economics student at Edge of Oss Bedfordview, and he's currently completing his work, integrated learning, right here at High FM as a news intern. Now, today we're looking at three very different stories, which tells us something important about our country this year. The election of a new parliamentary impeachment committee chairperson, a heartwarming crowdfunding campaign for a Hawks officer whose coffee machine was stolen, and the ongoing crisis of youth unemployment that President Ramaphosa has called the country's biggest threat. Eliezer, good afternoon to you and welcome back. Great to have you in studio once again.
Thank you for having me again.
Great to have you on board. So let's start in Parliament. Makashule Ghana of Rise Mzanzi has been elected chairperson of the Impeachment Inquiry Committee. Now, for listeners who may not know, what exactly is this committee and why is the position important?
So this committee is a follow-up from the Concord ruling that we talked about, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, on the weekly roundup. So the court ruled that the Section 89 panel report had to be implemented and that a committee should be created in order to go ahead with an inquiry into impeachment into the president. It is important because this position literally holds the position of the president in his hands.
Okay, and what is the composition of this committee? What are we looking at? And I take it now we've got, representatives from all parties. Is there a dominant party or is it evenly spaced out?
It is based on vote percentages. ANC have the most, followed by the DA. I think in total there's 31 members.
If we look at the vote, it wasn't particularly close. Ghana secured 19 votes against Wonderboy Malatsi's 12. So what does that result tell us about the alliances currently forming inside Parliament? What are we seeing transpiring there?
If you look at the parties that voted for each candidate, it's still largely the GNU parties versus the non-GNU parties. At the moment, it hasn't seemed to be the big fault lines we were expecting along those lines. And then, of course, Rise Mzanzi, who usually are part of the non-GNU bloc, actually voted for this candidate also because the candidate was from their party.
You know, Ghana himself has an interesting political journey, having previously served in the DA before joining Rise Mzanzi. So let's look at how significant is it that someone from one of Parliament's smaller parties now chairs such a powerful committee. What do you make of that?
If we look at how the process went about, his candidacy was a compromise candidacy in the first place. So the ANC nominated their own candidate, and then that candidate was rejected, and then they compromised on having Ghana as the candidate. But his own history is probably more important than the fact that there's a small party. Of course, they had to have a candidate from a party that's not in the GNU, because they had to maintain the credibility of the committee, and all of the big parties are already in the government of national unity.
You know, interesting what you've just mentioned. Could this appointment become, if I can put it this way, a defining moment for Rise Mzanzi as it seeks to establish itself as a serious force in local politics?
If we look at their actions so far, they certainly have tried to use the committee chairs they've already gotten. They have the chair of the SCOPA, which is a committee which is responsible for public accounts, and they have done quite a good job in there. And this also is interesting because Ghana himself is actually a product of the DA pipeline. I'm sure the DA themselves will probably claim the credit for this. It's probably one of the reasons they supported him, is because it's only been not a few years since he actually left the party. He spent most of his career within the Democratic Alliance, and there isn't really any indications that he's committed to all of the Rise Mzanzi positions. rather than the DA ones, even if he switched parties.
Well, time certainly will tell. Let's look, Eliezer, let's look at the impeachment committee itself. It exists to hold some of the country's highest office bearers accountable. So what message do you think that this election sends out about Parliament's oversight role and the balance of power within the government of national unity era?
So the first message is that nobody is immune to the law. Another thing is that we've been seeing, before the formation of the government of national unity, the executive often ran roughshod over the legislature or the National Assembly. And now what we're seeing is a lot of the parliament's functions, which before existed, but the ANC used as a rubber stamp to protect the members, are now suddenly coming to life. And this is another one, of course. And also it just shows that all parties that are elected have a role to play and not just the ones that are in government.
Let's move on to our next topic, the Hawks officer and the coffee machine. It's a story that's captured South Africa's heart, it seems, a story that couldn't be more different. Now, this week, South Africans rallied behind Hawks warrant officer Carl Sunder after learning that his beloved coffee machine was stolen during the theft of hundreds of kilograms of cocaine from a Hawks office. Now, for those who've missed the story, take us through it. What exactly happened here?
So back in November 2021, the Port Shepstone Hawks office was broken into and 500 kilograms of cocaine was stolen. Then the Madlanga Commission, which has been investigating police misconduct, had Officer Carl Sunder, who is part of the Hawks. He's a warrant officer who's a veteran of nearly 40 years. And he revealed that at the time he was on leave and that his office had also been broken into and that his coffee machine had been stolen. And after he returned, they subjected him to a polygraph test, which obviously proved he was innocent. He didn't steal his own coffee machine, obviously.
You know what makes what's intriguing about the story is the public response. I mean, within days, more than, 400,000 had reportedly been raised. And why do you think South Africans connected or identified so strongly with this particular story?
I think there's two parts of us. The first thing is I think we're very desperate for sort of a hero. With everything that's going wrong, we want like this idea of a stand-up like public servant. And he sort of embodies that mold. Another thing is it's very relatable. Like we've all had an experience close to this, whether it's our own house has been broken into or been witness to a crime or know somebody who has been a victim of it. It's becoming, unfortunately, the South African experience, and there's very few people that haven't heard of a situation like this.
You know, interestingly, in the story, the officer described the coffee machine as his, if I can quote, safe space, unquote, after nearly four decades in law enforcement. Now, let's look at this lighter-heartedly, if we can put it that way. Do you think this speaks to a broader appreciation for public servants who quietly do difficult jobs every day?
I think it might be, definitely. There definitely needs to be more. I think we've always appreciated, or wanted to appreciate authority in this country, which just never really have had like a role model to look to. It's also interesting, the fact that he's been there so long, if you do the math, like it is a bit of an uncomfortable thing to look at, but it's obvious South African democracy has only been around for 32 years. So he obviously came through in the last few years of apartheid. But even then, can see the fact that he's stuck around for so long just to do his job is something that certainly should be admired.
You know, we look at a time when so much of the news cycle, we look at it dominated by conflict, corruption, crisis. I'm curious, from your perspective, how important are stories like this in reminding us of the generosity that still exists in South African society? What does that tell you?
It is incredibly important. I mean, number one, first of all, mental health is not good to be looking at all the negativity all the time and seeing, you know, just spending the time doom scrolling. The other thing is we have to remember that we still have some sort of civic accountability in this country. You know, that just because the government's always failing doesn't mean that there aren't some people within the institutions that are good. And also within the public, we're still like a great nation.
Sure. Youth unemployment, the biggest threat to South Africa's future. And I'd like you also to come in here and elaborate where you deem necessary on the issue. Let's now look at the country's, or one of the country's most pressing challenges. We had the president recently describing youth unemployment as the biggest threat facing our country. That's a powerful statement, but, well, do you agree with that assessment? Let's start there.
Of course, this is an issue that hits close to home because I'll soon be in that. Once I finish university, I'll officially be part of that group of unemployed youth.
Hopefully not, but hopefully okay, not. That's for another discussion. Okay, carry on.
Hopefully not, no. But I think yes and no. It's a big statement to make with all the problems that we have that this is the biggest. I think personally that crime is a bigger overall like threat to the future of the country. It's also a discussion of cause and causation and symptoms and the problem itself, because you can argue that crime and youth unemployment are interlinked, but you can't really solve one without each other.
Okay, that's one aspect. It leads me to my next question. Let's look at the latest figures, which appear alarming, to put it mildly, with unemployment amongst young people aged 15 to 24 sitting above 60%. So beyond these statistics, what else are the real-world consequences of a generation struggling to find work? You have outlined crime. What else do you think comes into play here?
So besides crime, there's the brain drain. Many people who are educated do and have the funds do go overseas. Like, we're often training people and then we just don't use them. And then overseas, they go and achieve things that we don't see here. That's one of them. The other thing is just a general, like, state of despondency. Because youth are the future of the country, if they're not able to find jobs, then there isn't really much going on.
Okay, on a positive or enlightening note, government has announced this 1 billion rand investment into infrastructure projects. Now, that includes healthcare facilities and roads to stimulate growth and create jobs. Do you think this is likely to make a meaningful difference, or is the challenge simply too large?
It can make a difference. It again is a conversation of whether or not this is treating the symptoms or the problem itself. I do think the government now have identified that without economic growth, we can't have jobs. That's the biggest thing. So of course the infrastructure is one of the problems. It costs a lot of money to get to work. You have the potholes everywhere. All of these things make it harder to do business in this country. But it's not going to be a problem that can be just solved by throwing money at it.
There was a summit recently, Future of Jobs. That's what it was called. Of course, now we have discussions around investing in industries of the future, such as AI and emerging technologies. A lot of talk. But now here's the bottom line. Do you think the country is moving quickly enough to prepare young people for these opportunities, and let alone, for that matter, implementing such opportunities quickly, if I can put it that way?
Not at all. I don't think so. I mean, the government themselves was still kind of focused on, you hear them talk about mining and agriculture, so like the old-fashioned jobs. Nothing wrong with those sectors. Of course, we need them. We need all sectors to grow. But, and then when it comes to preparing youth for this type of opportunities, it depends. Because of the massive levels of inequality, some people are luckier than others if you're able to go to university and get private education. But the public education is certainly not. And the environment, I don't think, is conducive at the moment to innovation and those type of initiatives.
Interesting you should say that, because it leads to my next question, where we've seen before that job creation was possible. We're looking between 2004 and 2010. During that time, South Africa added millions of jobs. So what lessons can policymakers take from that period? What was different about it? What can we learn from that?
So a lot of that was policy, and I will get to that, but it was also just good fiscal management. So they always had funded budgets, they always had, so when it comes to policy, you have to be careful with the amount of regulation. Mm-hmm. Back then, we've seen the starters of things such as triple BE and things like that, but all of the labor laws weren't as strict as they are now. So when there's so much red tape, the businesses don't actually want to operate in the country. When you can look at another country like Rwanda, where they're inviting businesses, it's safer, and you don't have so much bureaucracy. So why would you choose South Africa over that?
You know, Eliezer, there's an argument that was being made. Actually, it's ongoing right now that South Africa South Africa just cannot solve today's employment crisis using yesterday's industries. So what sectors then should the country be prioritizing if it wants to create sustainable jobs over the next decade? And for, if I can add to that, let's think creatively. Let's think, I don't like using that that corporate term out the box, but I think you know what I'm getting at. What else could South Africa be looking at to expand its industrial base, its business sector, etc., to create more employment?
We need to look into renewable energies. One of the resources we do have is sun. Mm-hmm. Even now with the with all the clouds, it's still going to, at some point it'll come out. We have some of the most amount of sunlight hours in the world. So we should look into that, solar power and the like. It is expensive, but once you've done the groundwork, it pays for itself eventually. I don't think artificial intelligence could be, but I don't think at the moment it's necessarily sustainable, because there have been cases where they've had to actually get humans to come back in because it's too expensive and because it's often unreliable. So we have to look at sectors that are both worthwhile and also, as you said, sustainable.
Before I let you go, if you had to identify one intervention that could make the biggest difference to youth unemployment right now, what would it be and why?
So besides actually fixing things like crime and stuff, which would take a complete overhaul of policing, I think we need to start looking at deregulation. It's obviously a controversial thing to say because it's often along ideological lines and with the history of everything in the country. But we have to look at things like, is our taxes too high, corporate taxes, things like that? Is there too much bureaucracy? Like, is one of the reasons that businesses don't want to hire people, is it because it's too hard to comply with both all the trade union protections and the BEE and the like? Is that, we have to look, is that policy itself a problem or is it just implementation? I think things like that, and once we've got more market-friendly policies, if that doesn't work, then you can look at other things, but that's what I would do.
Well, certainly this week's stories remind us of the many sides of South Africa. On one hand, we are seeing Parliament shaping the institutions which keep our democracy accountable. On another, we're seeing ordinary citizens coming together to support a public servant in an unexpected act of generosity. And looming over it all is that challenge of youth unemployment, a crisis that will require innovation, investment, and bold thinking if South Africa is to unlock its full potential. I've been chatting to Eliezer Enfield. Eliezer is a third-year politics, philosophy, and economics student at Eduvos Bedford View, currently completing his work, Integrated Learning, right here at Chai FM as a news intern. Eliezer, thanks so much for joining us in studio today. And that's all for this week's Weekly News Roundup. Join us again next week as we look beyond the headlines and unpack the stories shaping our country.